Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. Hope you had a wonderful extended holiday weekend, and that if you did any travel by air, you didn't get into any extramarital affairs or romantic entanglements with your airport security agents, that your waistline remains felt and your football team prevailed, and wherever you are tonight, that you've got your Snuggie on and the warm pair of socks and you are ready to roll. One item I want to mention before we get started, if you listened to our show a week ago, you might have noticed we lost the signal for a couple of minutes. No idea why it happened, but as you might imagine, it's a spooky, scary thing to happen on this end, frustrating as well. And the problem was immediately investigated by the folks at Premier. They ran all kinds of tests on the line. Then they contacted CenturyLink, the telephone company, and bright and early, 9 a.m. Thanksgiving morning, this technician, Paul, came to meet me to check out the problem and see if he could figure it out. He ran a bunch of tests on the line, couldn't find anything wrong that he could duplicate. But I was amazed that they would send someone out early on a holiday morning, but they did. And as it turns out, Paul from CenturyLink is a regular listener of Coast to Coast, and he saw the book sitting on my desk that was the basis of our interview last Sunday. And he sort of put two and two together, and he says, aha, this is where you broadcast Coast to Coast. I listen to it all the time. So, Paul, tip of the hat to you and to CenturyLink for coming to the rescue on Thanksgiving morning, and I hope you enjoyed the rest of your holiday. If for some reason something like this happens again, folks, the live broadcast drops out, a tape show comes on, I promise we would do our best to fix it immediately. So please don't give up on us. If there is a problem, we'll be back on the air just as quickly as we can. And resume the live broadcast, but we don't anticipate that happening again. Can't really figure out what went wrong anyway. A few months ago, as you know, it was my pleasure to welcome back to the program one of the seminal figures in modern UFO research. He's not a scientist by training, but he has certainly learned a lot about how science works or doesn't work. Rather, he's not an investigator by background, but he became one by necessity. He is, at least in my opinion, at first glance, far too cultured and even-tempered and genteel for the sometimes rough-and-tumble, backbiting world of ufology. And yet he has proven to be more than meets the eye with a steely resolve that has served him well and which has opened up an entirely new chapter, both wonderful and terrible, the alien abduction scenario. We had Bud Hopkins on for a couple of hours a few months ago. It wasn't nearly enough, so I invited him back to talk with us about a few of the most important cases he has researched, ones we did not cover the last time, about the future of abduction research itself and his own future. And I might have a surprise or two for Bud along the way. He'll be joining me in just a couple of minutes. In the second half of tonight's program, hours 3 and 4, something we have not considered on this program before, at least to my knowledge. And to tell the truth, I don't know what to make of it myself. I mentioned this website several weeks ago, Ancient Canal Builders. Someone had sent me a link, and I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. And the folks behind this website started seeing patterns, strange patterns, seeming evidence of old structures, canals, maybe even language in marshes and swampland and estuaries, as seen from Google and other satellites. And tonight, making his first appearance on Coast, is the guy who founded this website, John Jensen, who has a technical background and a healthy sense of curiosity about prehistory. And I look forward to hearing what he has to say about all these structures. Think you'll be interested as well. Our webmaster, Tim Binal, has helped me put together something a bit different for tonight. Not our usual Knapp's news tidbits, but folks, don't head to the website just yet. We'll talk about the Coast website in just a bit. I want to go to our first break and then bring on our friend and colleague, author, artist, investigator, the incomparable Bud Hopkins. So don't go anywhere. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for being with us, everyone. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, and it is my pleasure to welcome back to the program the guy who is probably more responsible than anyone for putting the alien abduction scenario on the public's radar screen through his books, lectures, TV appearances, even his art. And I'm also pleased to call him a friend, Bud Hopkins. Thanks for coming back, Bud.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Always enjoy talking to you, George.
Well, the last time you were here, we sort of dove headfirst into your latest book, the memoir, Art, Life, and UFOs, a Memoir. It's a fascinating account of your journey through the strange worlds of art and ufology and just life in general. And we certainly didn't have time to cover everything, so I'm really glad you agreed to come back and pick up where we left off. The end of the book, go ahead.
I'm sorry. One of the things that I thought I would like to bring up is the fact that I've still got new cases coming in all the time, and I'm actually working with new people. So the abduction phenomenon is not dropping off or anything like that. It's still, unfortunately, very active.
And do you anticipate writing additional, at least articles, if not books?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know at this point. My energy level is very low, unfortunately. Some pills I'm taking have as their side effect low energy, lethargy, and so forth. And I started off actually looking for some kind of medicine because I was already of low energy and so on. So it's kind of a double whammy. And I can still get up and tie my shoes, but, you know, the idea of writing another book is just out of the question, I think.
Well, I know I wrote one a couple of years ago, and it darn near killed me. I know you are both candid about your personal life, as in the memoir, amazingly candid at points, but also you are intensely private about some aspects of your life, as we all are. You touched on your health situation the last time you were here, and since then I have heard from so many of your colleagues who are understandably concerned. They're interested in how you're doing. They pick up scraps of information third or fourth hand. Is there anything that you want to say, or you can just tell me to skip it, to the folks who are hoping that you're with us for a long time?
I think I'd rather skip it. It's just that I'm not well, and, of course, I'm going to be 80 in June. So the combination of health problems and age would suggest that I'm not going to be busy writing books for a while.
At the end of your memoir, it almost sounds like a farewell. You write about how life has been very good to you, and you're filled with sorrow that there's so little of it left. I mean, referring to your age. And then you discuss your spiritual views, that you're not convinced that there is an afterlife, at least not the one that's been presented to us by various organized religions. Let's start there. And in doing so, as you talk about what you think comes next, can you also weave in how your research into the UFO abduction scenario may have changed your views on spirituality, if at all?
Well, first of all, about the idea of consciousness after death. I mean, I suppose I'm you would call me a skeptic. My partner Leslie Kane has been very deeply involved in that subject. And she's now gone to Europe for 2 weeks to do a film shoot. The History Channel is doing a one-hour program on her book. And so she's over there interviewing General de Brouwer in Brussels on the Brussels cases, and General Letty in Paris. General Jafari is going to be there. He's from Iran in that very famous case.
Oh.
But anyway, she's over there. And just before she left, she handed me two books on survival of consciousness after death. And I promised her I would read them. So, or at least the first one. I am going to delve into this as a favor to her and very possibly a favor to myself. But that's the whole question is kind of up in the air right now as to what I think of survival of consciousness. I would certainly wish that there was something. And, of course, one of the things when you're my age and you have all kinds of illnesses, I wrote about lymphoma, which I was a form of cancer, which I was diagnosed with 12 years ago. So you have plenty of time to face death and think about it. And I've actually been writing a journal, totally private, shown to no one. But just putting down all my thoughts about lots of things, and it's really been spiritually uplifting to me to be able to do this, to know that I will be leaving behind some kind of testament that to all kinds of things, to all kinds of aspects. I went into a tirade on politics the other day on it, but I've been writing on every kind of subject just for myself. So I'm keeping busy about the whole subject, for sure.
Have your views on the afterlife or whatever comes next been affected by your research into the abduction scenario, into learning about these intruders or visitors, whatever? Has that changed your view at all?
No, I really think it hasn't. As far as I'm concerned, the alien phenomena, if you want to call it that, meaning the intelligences who were piloting these craft and doing these things, seem to be, to me, somewhat like human beings. And I mean, first of all, they're humanoid in appearance, but that, like humans, they make mistakes. They stumble. They leave traces. They knock things down. In other words, there's something about them that's very familiar to us, except that, of course, there's a technology there and an ability mentally to control people and so forth that, you know, just goes far beyond anything we have. So I don't think my idea of some sort of survival of consciousness is tied up with it at all. And as a matter of fact, to be very truthful, I'm not going to be regretful if I'll pass on without having discovered anything more about the phenomenon that I already know, because it is very depressing. And when you have a 3.5-year-old grandchild, you sort of worry about how that child's future is going to unfold and what kinds of problems she'll have if there should be something more happening, let's say, in the sense of some landings that are absolute and whatever might happen, we don't know. But I don't look at it as potentially a good thing.
Your general view of the phenomenon, maybe we're jumping in this too soon, but we might as well since you mentioned it, is not optimistic.
No, it isn't. And it hasn't been. And from the beginning, you have to remember, George, that I got involved in this whole subject sort of by accident. I mean, it's a long story I tell in my book, but the point is I didn't go out searching and so forth. I just found out one thing more than I knew the day before or the month before. And incidentally, in terms of just learning new things, I thought I'd like to mention something that came to my attention that's very, very interesting. Now, I have no way of connecting it with the UFO phenomenon, except that there have been a couple of other cases where this sort of thing has happened. And one of the things was that I was dealing with a very nice young man who was a physical therapist, was helping me after I came out of the hospital with a bout of pneumonia. But at any rate, he started talking about the UFO subject because I had to explain what I do for a living. So he said, well, nothing ever strange happened to me. He said, I was born on a farm in southern Illinois. But he said there was a very strange thing. It was a very big field. And the field connected the property of a number of people. So there was a lot of crossing the field to get to neighbors' houses and so forth. And he said, when he was about 13 or 14, I think, he said one of the neighbors came to the house very excited because of this hole in the ground. And people were gathering from the neighbors to look at the hole. The hole was about 30 inches across, but he said it was 35 feet deep, and it was an absolutely perfect coring of the ground that had occurred somehow magically. There was no dirt spread anywhere that could have come out of this hole. It's a huge amount of dirt, of course. Something is 35 feet deep by 30 inches across. And he said there was no sign of how anybody could have gotten into the hole or out of the hole to do the digging. He said it was just like a magical thing. And he said people were really kind of excited about it. They lived there. And they finally, I guess, had the deputy sheriff come out. And the deputy sheriff looked at it and clucked and didn't have any idea how to explain it. He said, well, I guess kids did it. But the thing is, about the missing dirt, there have been a couple of cases. There was a case, I remember, in Switzerland where a very large area of soil was taken, in this case from a rectangle that was something like, 15 feet long by 10 feet deep and so forth, with, again, no sign of the dirt that came from it. Now, what is going on here? Do our friends in the sky need soil for some reason? Are they growing things? I mean, what's going on? But this would seem to be just a new wrinkle in the whole thing. I'm just guessing. I'm just speculating. But I would certainly love to hear from anybody tonight who has run into anything like this.
Well, I can tell you right now a case that the Skinwalker Ranch, the Bigelow property in Utah,
yeah.
The rancher who lived there before had an experience like that where it looked like someone came into his property with a giant cookie cutter and carved holes and carted off the dirt. Now, this is hundreds of pounds of dirt from each of these holes. They would have needed heavy equipment. He would have been able to hear it. It happened one night, and he has no explanation for it whatsoever.
I know. So, well, that's exactly like this. And I think it's definitely connected with the UFO phenomenon. That's just the best guess I could make. But just this was new to me. And I guess I did know that about the ranch. But hearing this from by accident from my physical therapist was sort of a shock. And, of course, it just goes to show that this whole phenomenon is so, in a way, intrusive into our world. One of the neighbors in this case I was describing almost fell into the hole. He was walking across and not paying too much attention, and there was, of course, a perfect rim and no sign of any disturbance. So as he's walking without looking down, he almost fell into it. And they had to get bulldozers to push the soil all around it that, had not been disturbed at all. But what is going on with that? Well, we got your cases and this case, and there was this Swiss case that I mentioned. So it's a very real aspect of the phenomenon. And it just shows that it seems to have so many different wrinkles to it, dimensions.
But I took the liberty of asking some of your best-known colleagues to send in best wishes to you to talk about your place in the pantheon of this wacky and wonderful research that we know, what your work means to humanity, how it's touched the lives of other people. We've posted these messages here on the Coast to Coast website on a special tribute page, and they've come in from all over the world, from the likes of Stan Friedman, Jerry Clark, astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Don Schmidt, Bruce McAbee, and a lot of others. And I don't want to embarrass you too much. Okay, maybe a little bit, but I will. I had intended to sprinkle a few of these comments through our 2 hours together just to let you know how folks feel about you in case you don't know now. And the outpouring is dramatic and heartfelt, and I hope you're not too mad at us about doing this.
No
comment.
Not at all.
Okay. Well, I'm going to, as I said, we'll sprinkle some of those in throughout the program and maybe get your reaction. As I said, they're on a special tribute page on the Coast website, and we'll certainly send you a copy of the material. I want to get into talking about ufology. And I definitely want to touch on mainstream science, your observations on that, of course, and your experiences with them. But I don't want to jump in first with ufology, some of the politics, some of the personalities, and see if you want to get some things off your chest. We'll get to that when we come back. My special guest, Bud Hopkins. This is Coast to Coast AM. Bud Hopkins, I made the observation, and maybe it's not a fair one, that for a cultured and kind man as yourself, it almost seems like you are sometimes out of place in the wild and wacky and sometimes vicious world of ufology, though you certainly proved that you not only belonged there, but were a vital component in the research movement and had steely resolve and could stand up to anybody. But do you, at this point, what are your general reflections on the world of ufology, the progress that's been made or lack thereof?
Well, I think enormous progress has been made, at least in the area of abduction research. David Jacobs and I and others have found patterns that seem to be replicated again and again and again, so that you can say with great assurance this is what they are doing. And that means that we have to try to figure out what that means for human beings in the long run. But in terms of what's going on in the wild and woolly UFO world, I mean, first of all, I suppose everybody has a right to try to make some money, but there are people who, some of whom I know, who seem to have had abduction experiences, legitimate ones, and have somehow transformed themselves into counselors charging other abductees money to talk to them, I guess, on the phone or Skype or whatever. And it just seems to me to be really dishonest to be in that situation, to charge money for people who have also had experiences, but basically getting them hooked because you were saying you are yourself an abductee. I've not charged people myself when I worked with them, and David Jacobs hasn't, a number of other people, John Mack has not charged. But the point is, we're doing a particular service. The actual hypnosis is, of course, a service that's extremely valuable to the abductee that we're dealing with. But this idea of everybody setting up shop as some kind of counselor is, to me, really a kind of disgusting practice. So that's already, I'm not going to mention names, but that's already a side of this that I find extremely disturbing.
Well, you mentioned your friend Dr. David Jacobs, and I don't want to go too far down this road because I want to give him a chance to be here to talk about this himself. But he's in the latest issue of UFO Magazine. He gets smacked for protocols he uses with research subjects where he takes control, is alleged to have taken control of their lives and their stories and gets them to sign these deals. And I know that you have also been hammered at times about, well, you're not a scientist, you shouldn't be doing regressions, things of that sort. Talk to me first about the onslaught of criticism that sort of goes hand in hand with this, and then specifically about Dr. Jacobs, your relationship with him, and how closely you share the same sort of worldview.
Well, I'll take that last part first. I think we're extremely close on our way of handling the abductees that come to us, and we are reaching the same kinds of conclusions about what seems to be going on. Now, David has gone much further than I in researching the idea of hybrid beings being here on Earth. Now, I know that that's automatically the most complicated and disturbing thought. Any scientist who doesn't know anything about the subject would hear that and run the other way as fast as it could. One of the reasons for the success of Leslie Kane's book is that she doesn't go into any of this, even abduction. She just goes into the issue of these objects, which are metallic and can be photographed and return a radar beam and so forth, interacting with pilots and leaving ground traces, et cetera, because she felt if you can get that door open, the scientists would say, okay, we got to find out what these things are. Eventually, those people can be moved into the area of, all right, are these things piloted? And if so, what kinds of beings or intelligences are piloting them and so forth? And Dave, of course, is at the far end of all of this. And it's very, very, very difficult for him to get a hearing. But he has some very powerful evidence. Now, I forgot what the first part of the question was.
Well, we were just in general attacks on you for...
the attacks. Yeah. Well, it's one attack, and I will mention the name because it was published and I published a rebuttal. One attack, which I remember vividly, published in the MUFON Journal by, I'm trying to think.
Well, give us the gist of it, and we'll come back.
James Goh, okay. He said that, and he was a UFO investigator, that the UFO community should prevent artists and historians, meaning myself and Dave Jacobs, from doing hypnosis because this was somehow distorting the whole subject and so on and so forth, and that no one should ever do hypnosis with somebody if they know anything about the abduction phenomenon, which is like saying if the police are trying to use hypnosis to solve a crime, the hypnotist shouldn't know a damn thing about the crime. It's ludicrous. And this man said, thank God that we have Philip Glass to try to keep us honest. That was probably the most bizarre attack that I can remember. I'm probably deliberately blocking the author's name of that, but very, very well known in the UFO community.
Let me give you another name that's very well known, and you write about this person in your memoir, and it's Whitley Strieber, who he wrote Communion and other books. He's sold millions of books. He's been on this program, hosted this program. I think he's a very sharp mind and had some actual legitimate experiences, but there seemed to have been some touchy feelings there at about the time his book came out and your book came out, right?
Well, that's all a very complicated thing to try to squeeze into this program.
Okay.
But I think that I agree that Strieber has had abduction experiences, but that there are aspects of his personality which are, for various reasons, shaky. I won't go any further than that, knowing that he's extremely litigious. But the point is that he once said to me, and I mentioned this in the book, that he had trouble telling the difference between fantasy and reality. And that could be something that happened to him as a result of his abduction experiences, but also the fact that he's been a horror story writer and a science fiction writer all his life. So maybe those two things do get mixed up, fantasy and reality. And that means that unless you can find a some kind of corroboration to the things he's saying, you can't be that certain of them. And I once defined his writing, because I think this is, it's a sort of a psychological state that he's in, but I defined his writing as involuntary fiction.
I wonder how much of that comes with the territory, Bud, in that the confabulations that happen, the visions and the confusion that that seem to come along with the abduction experience of screen memories and things, that a lot of this is foisted upon us, according to the case accounts, by the visitors themselves. You can't tell dream from reality, right? Yeah.
No, I think that's a grounded observation about the whole phenomenon. That's why it takes a lot of skill and experience to try to help people sort out what really happened and what was kind of forced into their minds and memories by the UFO occupants. Incidentally, I never call them visitors. Visitors are people who seem to have a benign intent. And
sounds like you invite them to your house or something.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, you come in for Thanksgiving. But these people can be very frightening most of the time.
Let's talk about movies and TV. I mean, there's been so much of this stuff in recent years since you've been on the scene. I guess CBS did a two-part series about your Intruders book. There was a Spielberg series that was a multi-part series that was excellent, Taken. There, of course, is an older movie about Betty and Barney Hill. There was a movie version of Communion that wasn't too bad, Fire in the Sky. And then, of course, this most recent monstrosity about abductions in Nome, Alaska, the fourth kind.
And total fraud. Absolutely total fraud. There's not one thing about it that's true. And I've always advised anybody who even heard of the movie to avoid it.
You know, they could have just made that movie and just made it as a work of fiction without the claims that it's all based on case files and recordings and things like that, and left it at that.
Well, imagine the idea that the movie promulgates that a man under hypnosis for the first time about his abduction goes berserk and goes home and shoots his wife and children and himself. How's that going to entice people to look into their experiences? I mean, that's just bizarre and dangerous.
And did you see effects? Were there people that you've worked with, case study people that you've worked with, who were affected by this, who were in a negative sense?
Yeah, yes, there were people who were very frightened. I did deal with a group of people, a number of people who had seen it and were really wanted to know, does this happen, you know, in this way? In other words, do you get hypnotized and shoot everybody in your family? I was quite amazed to hear from a friend that a man who was high up in the MUFON hierarchy said it was his favorite movie. He'd seen it four times. I just could not believe my ears when I heard that.
Speak to me in general about Hollywood and UFOs, Hollywood and abductions. Your observations in general, how you've been treated by these folks, how the subject material has been treated.
Well, I think that Intruders, the miniseries, was the closest I've seen to the actual emotional after effects of abductions and the way they can disrupt a family and so forth. The trouble is that Dan Curtis, who was the director, wanted to over-dramatize everything. So when a little boy in the miniseries is rushed to the hospital with severe hemorrhaging from a nosebleed because the aliens stuck something up there, I said to Curtis, well, people can sometimes have nosebleeds, but nobody's, rushed to the hospital and is teetering on the edge of death because of this. And he said, I know, but this is more dramatic. So you've got the sense that Hollywood has to underline everything 10 times, unfortunately, even though the emotional interactions of the film were very good. The problem, of course, is that it diverged pretty heavily from my book, because each of the two main characters in the book, which is essentially me as the investigator and Kathy Davis as the abductee, each of us was turned into two different personalities, two different people. So there were four central people in the film, and the whole thing got overly complicated. But at any rate, I've always said that I gave it a B+, which is pretty good for me.
Of course, you know, the critics have said, oh, yeah, all this stuff about abductions, people are coming forward because they see a movie, they read a book, they see that alien on the cover of Communion, and then they start seeing aliens in real life, and it's all a power of suggestion. I would imagine there's an element of that that is true. I would also imagine there's an element of people seeing these movies and having genuine memories rekindled, and suddenly it dawns on them, hey, this really did happen.
That's absolutely true. I mean, the reaction, see, first of all, Strieber put an alien face, which that's a whole issue I go into in the book, which is, I think, a very interesting aspect. But he put an alien face on the cover of the book, and one of the people at his publishing company told me, proudly, he said, this is a $1 million cover. And, of course, if you try to think of any other book cover of any other book ever that's more memorable than that, it's hard to hard to come up. Excuse me.
Well, sure, that image is burned into all of our consciousness now. Yeah.
But the thing is that it certainly did bring a lot of genuine abductees to consciousness, partial consciousness about their experiences. So in that sense, it was very helpful.
But as you note, a lot of them came forward and said, hey, you know, that alien looks somewhat familiar, but its head is wrong, right?
Yeah, that was one of the things I found very interesting. Because when Strieber called me to come over and look at this painting, I had been the one who handed the artist onto him in the first place. He said, this is exactly what I saw, exactly. And I took one look at it. I said, Whitley, that has a pinhead. This is they have big craniums. The heads are very big. And this is really weird, this little pinhead thing. And he looked at it and kind of disappointed. And he said, yeah, I guess you're right. I guess they did have bigger heads. But what this meant was a number of people, God knows how many wrote to him, but a number of them wrote to me and said, I looked at that cover and I thought, where have I seen this before? This is familiar. Those eyes are familiar. And then they would say to themselves, but the head's wrong. And then he would think, how do I know the head's wrong? Where did I see this before? You know, it became, in a strange way, it became kind of a test of the veracity of the person. Wow. If they saw the, were hypnotized looking at those eyes, but picked up the fact that the head wasn't right.
I want to ask you as well about something. It's not your case, but it's a very famous case. Travis Walton, Fire in the Sky was the name of the movie. The abduction experience is pretty well known. Not a typical abduction, but certainly has some elements of it. We'll get into that. And then I want to ask you about the future of UFO research, of alien abduction research, and a heck of a lot more, including some of Bud Hopkins' greatest hits and most important cases. Stay with us, everyone. Lots more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Coming up next hour, John Jensen, the founder of AncientCanalBuilders.com, will be here. But for the next hour, we have the one and only Bud Hopkins, premier UFO abduction researcher, author, investigator, and artist. And as I mentioned at the top of the program earlier, that a lot of his colleagues have sent in comments to be used on a special Bud Hopkins tribute page on our website, Coast to Coast AM, including John Schussler, the former head of MUFON, who said, Bud has been a godsend to all the individuals that were alone and afraid because of their UFO-related experiences. From young children to the elderly, all experiencers, abductees, missing time victims, or whatever you want to call them, Bud treats each with compassion and heartfelt concern. Even when attacked by the so-called skeptics, he remained true to his mission, helping others. Bud is a superhero in this field. And Stan Friedman, our friend, who said, Bud has, in my opinion, done more to get people involved in abduction research and to take the subject seriously than anybody else. He made it okay to consider the subject and has brought a number of people out of the closet. Hopefully, more professionals in the field of psychology and psychiatry will pick up the torch. We'll come back in just a moment and resume our conversation with Bud Hopkins about some of the most important cases he's ever investigated. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Bud Hopkins, this is not one of your cases, but I've always wanted to get your opinion on it, and that's the Travis Walton case. It was made into a movie called Fire in the Sky. I met Travis Walton, found him to be a very credible guy. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. He's one of the most credible people one can imagine, and that's a terrific case. And his writing is extremely good about his experiences. But one thing that should be mentioned is that Tracy Torme, Mel Torme's son, wrote the screenplay for Intruders, and he was then hired to write the screenplay for Fire in the Sky. Obviously he was trying to get the abduction scene inside the craft and so on to be accurate. But, the producers or the powers that be told him, no, it's got to be completely different than, Intruders. You can't seem to have the same looking aliens and the same procedures, because it wouldn't be interesting to people. You've got to write a whole new abduction scene. So poor Tracy had to sit down and invent the entire onboard experience that appears in the movie. And Travis always was upset about that, because you know, he wanted authenticity. And he seems in the movie, as I recall, like he's floating around inside a giant intestine of something. I don't know what, but the point is, it's that part was totally off. To find out what really happened, you can check out his books. He had two versions of the books about his experience, but it's an excellent case because it's part of it is witnessed by six other people. They passed polygraph tests. The whole thing really holds together. It's one of the key cases. And what's interesting is, of course, all the men were in the truck coming back from their job of clearing brush and driving along when they saw this craft and the whole thing unfolded. And yet you can have somebody like Susan Clancy, who is to science of, you know, what, I don't know, I don't know what to say, that's also not actionable, but she is the big skeptic on the subject, and she says the whole thing is sleep paralysis, six people driving along in a truck. At any rate.
Everybody went to sleep at the same time, I guess, huh?
I guess they did, yeah.
Well, you've faced that a number of times. You know, we talked about ufology. I want to talk about science or lack thereof. There was a program on Nova, which is supposedly a really good science program, and I've seen some great episodes. But they had Kidnapped by UFOs was the title of this program, and they produced it basically at your expense, right? I mean, they took great liberties with the facts of the cases.
Well, it was unbelievable because in that case, the family who lived in Florida had various members of the family, young family, had abduction experiences. And the husband, who agreed to go on camera, showed the camera people, and I'm standing there for all of this, where he was lying when he somehow was paralyzed and fell. And was against the wall. From the other side of the wall was his bedroom. He was trying frantically to move, to bang on the wall or something to get his wife alerted to what was happening, because as he was lying there, straddled by two or three aliens in different positions, he could see his little boy being floated out of the house at the end of the hall by other aliens. And he was very emotional about this. All of that was cut. They refused to put any of it in the film because their whole thing was to say this was sleep paralysis and or whatever they had in mind. But it was the way the thing was edited was just horrendous.
So basically, they went into this production with an idea how it was going to end up. This wasn't an investigation. It was a scripted program. They knew they were going to trash the research from the get-go.
Exactly, exactly. That was the worst experience I've ever had with television. I've had a lot of bad ones. I've had a lot of good ones, but the bad ones, this one is the top of the list.
And what do you make of that, Bud? I mean, how can they call themselves a science program and do something like that? How do you ethically juggle the facts like that and still call it science?
Well, I think that they can call anything science if they want to. But the basic thing that happens here, excuse me, is that they start off with the assumption there's nothing to this. So they shoot a lot of footage, and the footage that tends to support the reality of the experience, like the footage I just described, that's all cut. And anything that they can get in there that's sort of irrelevant or whatever, or that they can somehow warp, they will leave that in. It's a cherry-picking process that's totally, absolutely dishonest. It was the most dishonest piece of television I've ever seen.
Let's talk about maybe the centerpiece case that you have worked on. You wrote about it in a book called Witnessed. It's Linda Cortile, Linda Napolitano. It's the case that involved the Secretary General of the United Nations. I know it's a long and drawn out story. Can you capsulize it? And then I want to ask you a couple of questions about it.
Well, I've never said outright publicly who the third man was, an important person. The press has picked up the name you just mentioned or the rank, but I've never confirmed or denied anything about it. That case is so complicated. It has so many different witnesses to it. But in essence, Linda was somebody I'd been working with for about a year off and on because of her early experiences. And she called me one day to say something had happened the night before, and she remembered going out the window. And anyway, when we looked into this, what had happened is that she had floated out in very brilliant light and was then lifted up into the UFO. There were three little aliens with her. Now, that was where the thing sort of was left, and actually only part of that emerged under hypnosis. But I got a letter from two men who presented themselves as police officers who had seen this happen, witnessed it. And as I tried to deal with them and tried to locate them, they did not want to come forward, but they did come forward to her and actually frightened her. The whole thing is extremely,
they snatched her, right? They kidnapped her.
Complex. But ultimately, it turned out they were security people, and they were guarding an important individual who, along with a number of other people in this procession of cars, evidently witnessed what happened. I found witnesses. I was approached by a witness who saw the whole thing from her position on the Brooklyn Bridge. There was a witness down below on the FDR Drive. I mean, the whole thing is just rife with witnesses and testimony. And it's important, I think, to realize that this happened, excuse me, in 1989. It's a lot of years, over 20 years ago. And there were about 20 witnesses to one or another part of this whole thing. And all of them have stuck by their accounts Absolutely, as in the Travis Walton case, it's very, very hard for the skeptics, when you have so many witnesses, who would have to call it a hoax, to call it a hoax if 20 years later or much later than that with the Travis Walton case, no one has come forward, including children, to change their story. But it's a great case. I said in my book that in my memoir that the book witnessed on that case was in a way the closest to my heart because there was so much information that had to be controlled and put down. Even now, it's hard for me to remember exactly whether this happened before that or whether these two people were there or there were three, that kind of thing. But it's a major case.
But this, you know, the main events are in 89, but it continued to dribble in new information for, yep, for years, right?
Yeah. New witnesses turned up. Of course, one of the problems is witnesses who turn up after the book has been published,
right,
are already have a couple strikes against them. But, you know, I felt certainly in one of the witnesses that it was a very genuine, he was a genuine witness. And the second was certainly a genuine witness to the stopped motorcade.
I understand that you're being circumspect about the important man who was in a car down below and saw, yeah, some of this stuff happening. I will just say that other writers have identified this person as the Secretary General of the United Nations, and other writers have said that the two men who were with him were not just security guys. They were agents of a U.S. agency, an intelligence agency, who subsequently communicated with you about this very perplexing experience. And I'm not asking you to confirm what agency they work for or who that guy is. What I would ask you is, did they see it on purpose? And this is speculation on your part. Were they supposed to see it? Was the main,
yes,
guy?
The basic point, I think, because of all of the bright lights. See, first of all, we got abductions in all the major cities of the world, practically, which are not witnessed, not seen. So how does the thing get, you know, the museum tower next to the Museum of Modern Art, I had some people taken from something like the 22nd floor. Now, it's New York City in Midtown, but these things are done in such a way that they are unseeable. But in this case, this particular case, all the lights were turned on, and actually a couple of the witnesses told me that they thought they were watching a movie being made, a sci-fi movie, because of the lights were so bright. This was an attention-getting thing. And the motorcade, which had this important person and others, other important people, was deliberately stopped where it would have a perfect view. So this was kind of a showing off. This is as close as we get to the fabled idea of the landing on the White House lawn. And the whole thing took place in maybe 2 or 3 minutes.
So it's as if they can do this. They have ways, and you got into the study of invisibility, things of that sort, the physics of that sort of thing later, and we can talk about that. But there are ways that they can disguise this if they want to.
Absolutely.
When they make it obvious, when they make it obvious and allow people to see it, multiple witnesses, 20 witnesses, it's because they want to be seen. It's a display of sorts.
Yeah, well, actually, there were far more than 20 witnesses, but I'm talking about whoever has come forward that I've been able to contact.
Right, right.
But how many are there out there tossing and turning at night thinking, what the hell is going on in this world?
But the idea that that whoever is doing this wants to be seen once in a while for whatever reason, have you thought about what the reason is there? Why sometimes they do and sometimes they don't?
Well, that's one of the biggest mysteries of the whole phenomenon. How come they can be seen sometimes and not seen other times, be apparently invisible and sometimes seen? And we have the weird situation of them being invisible and yet being traceable on radar, even though the human eye cannot pick them up. What's going on here? Why isn't it one pattern? Why would they show off at one point and hide at another? The hiding is, of course, the biggest part of this. I mean, the abductions abduction, witnessed abductions are extremely rare, and abductions are extremely common as experiences. So it would seem that there most of the appearances really are invisible. Appearance is the wrong word. Incidentally, I should apologize for my voice. On top of everything, I've had a kind of chronic bronchitis, so my voice has gone from its normal baritone up to a high, thin, reedy tenor, which I'm embarrassed about, but it's the best I can do.
Well, it sounds good to me, Bud, and I hope to squeeze every drop out of you here. If you can hang on with us until the top of the hour, we're enjoying it very much. We talked in general about science, about your experiences with television and science television. What about scientists themselves? You mentioned Susan Clancy, who has sort of sprung toward the top of the heap of debunkers for this field out of the blue in the last couple of years. Have you had personal interaction with her? And what, if so, what's that been like?
Well, she and I both spoke very briefly. I think we had 10 minutes each at the American Psychological Association meeting in Boston. And the thing is, she preceded me, and she sort of so flummoxed me. She described the Hill case as, well, these people were driving along at night and they saw some light, and they pulled their car off the road, and they thought the light was moving. And then later on, they did hypnosis, and out came an abduction because they had seen something on television. And there was absolutely nothing about the fact that the Hills had seen the object fairly close, and through binoculars, they could see the aliens looking through windows at them. And so all of that, all conscious memory, she skipped, to make it sound like there was nothing to it. And then when I started talking talking about my experiences and the fact that that she had this very, very small sample of people she was working with trying to establish that they all had sleep paralysis, I said that we must have had a different sample, I said, because this has never come up. And she said, oh, no, I had some of your people in my sample. Well, that happened to be a lie. What she was thinking of is she had some of John Mack's people in her sample, but no one that I ever worked with. And I was so disturbed and confused that I hope I made sense. I was showing basically slides of physical marks on people, and scoop marks and straight line cuts, and the damage on the ground and so forth, to provide physical evidence that has nothing to do with sleep, anything.
Well, I suspect it's a lot easier in 10 minutes to muddy the waters than it is to make a persuasive case. Our conversation with one and only Bud Hopkins continues after this on Coast to Coast AM. I have in my hands a copy, a tattered paperback copy of Missing Time, the book by Bud Hopkins, written, I think, in 1981. This one is signed, Bud, by you here in Las Vegas, September 1991. And there's a section in there I wanted to read for you. It's toward the end where you talk about what can be done. That's the title of the chapter. And you wrote back then, the efforts of the many individuals and organizations throughout the world to investigate and record the UFO phenomenon and all its complexity are, despite the best intentions, inadequate. What's needed now is an official government effort, an agency whose purpose would be fourfold. And then you tell about what the four purposes would be. One, including an obligation to prepare the public for the day when the alien presence is obvious to everyone. From this vantage point now, 29 years later, does it seem naive to believe that that could ever happen?
Well, it was also new to me back in 81 that actually the book was written in 80, so it was 30 years ago. It was so new to me that I was being hopeful and trying to sort out what I was discovering. Perhaps it was, in retrospect, naive of me to think that something like that might happen. But at any rate, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen a different way. It's going to happen, I think, the way Leslie Kane has set it up, that we're only dealing with the investigation will only deal with these objects that are flying around. And the whole notion of the pilots, the crew, the aliens themselves has to be left to emerge from the investigation, but not be the subject of it. And obviously, that's going to be the same problem with the abduction phenomenon. But the point is, in the meantime, there's no reason why people in the mental health community can't get together and begin to look into this in a serious way. And, of course, quite a few of them have. Oddly enough, I've worked with 8 people. One I didn't work with very much, but 7 and then this other man, who were psychiatrists, who were also abductees. And I've worked with a number of psychologists and psychotherapists who were abductees. And I've been trying to, of course, get them to do this sort of work. But the problem for them is that if they're advertised as accepting the idea of alien abduction, maybe their list of clients and patients is going to drop. I mean, I can understand their worry. That's the problem with the whole notion of ridicule that has been officially brought on this subject by the government.
That's why I could never imagine a government-sanctioned program. I mean, it would make sense, of course, for, as you mentioned about Leslie Kane's approach of small bite-sized pieces, it would make sense for the government to find out what is intruding in our airspace, what is detected on our radar, what interferes with our missile control systems, things of that sort. But it just seems to be a paranoia that would just not allow them to take that step, even though it makes perfect sense to do so.
Exactly. It's the whole issue of this being so disturbing and so potentially scary and so damaging to somebody's to conventional wisdom in any of these fields, psychiatry or physical sciences and so on, means that people just stay away from it. And even though, as you say, it's absolutely the most logical thing in the world to do. And we did have, of course, with Project Blue Book and Alan Hynek's supervision there, we did have something going until they decided to do the Condon report and drop the whole subject.
I am generally pessimistic, but, you know, you look at the broad picture of what's happened in our lifetimes in this research, and there was a time when even in ufology, the UFO researchers didn't want to talk about aliens. They were comfortable saying that these are ships and spaceships from somewhere else, some other planet, but they were very uncomfortable in talking about the possibility there were aliens inside, let alone that aliens were abducting people. So at least ufologists have come a long way. Maybe the answer in the future, we will not have a government-sanctioned program, but if you're looking for a silver lining, maybe it could be something on the scale of what you described, that professionals, psychiatrists, psychologists, privately, on a small scale, take these cases seriously and try to help people through these traumatic experiences.
Well, it's certainly would seem possible that something like that could happen. And I felt, of course, that I've been successful in bringing some mental health professionals into this, most famously, of course, John Mack, but a number of others. And I think there are a number of people who are working sort of secretly without announcing that they accept the reality of this, but they are taking clients, taking patients, and helping them out. But as a matter of fact, I just received a referral from someone who I knew many years ago who was skeptical. This was a psychologist. And she sent me a referral. Somebody came to her with all of the earmarks of being an abductee, and she wasn't sure what to do. So she's sending this person on to me. It's a New Yorker anyway, so.
We touched on it briefly earlier about the ultimate direction that this phenomena is taking. And you are not optimistic. I mean, there are dark sides to this that you have discussed, that David Jacobs has discussed, that the ultimate truth is not going to be something that maybe humanity is ready to hear or that will have a happy ending where we all walk off into the sunset holding hands.
That's certainly true. I'd like to end the movies about the phenomenon that way, with people walking hand in hand into the sunset, but I'm afraid that's not the way it's going to be. I mean, it's the whole thing is a lot more ominous than I allow myself to think when I'm when my thoughts go in that direction. So it's a very, very difficult thing to face, especially when I think of my little granddaughter and all the rest of us. It doesn't look in any way optimistic. There's no way that you can find to say they have done good, they have helped, they have done, all of these good things that we would like to, that we used to hear from the so-called contactees and so on. There's no sign of that. And that's one of the most depressing things. I've said many times that during World War II, UFOs were very present, and I have a number of abductions from the 30s and even a couple from the 20s. But if they were flying around and doing their stuff, they didn't bother to save, one Jewish child from Auschwitz.
Do you foresee, and I don't know how much detail you want to get into, but do you see a time when there's some dramatic revelation that there is a landing, that they appear suddenly in the sky over major cities, or would your guess be that they continue to sort of pluck out individuals at will and do with us what they will, like cattle going to a slaughterhouse,
there's this much talk about quote unquote the word disclosure, which is one of my more hated words right now, as if it's all going to be very clear and the government's going to announce and they're going to land and it'll all be going into the sunset hand in hand or something. There are people, believe it or not, teaching courses in how to deal with the aliens when they arrive. If you can imagine collecting money for a course like that. But the point is that as far as I'm concerned, what I think is going to happen is more and more people, it really is happening, more and more people are becoming aware of the whole phenomenon in its many branches. And whether they're abductees themselves or no abductees, or that it's an issue of a sighting that's just beyond belief to them and so forth, whatever. More and more people are accepting the reality of this. So it's going to come from the ground up, from the people up, until perhaps the government decides that things are getting out of control and they've got to make some sort of statement. Although I don't know what that statement would be.
Yeah, I mean, what do we do about it?
The point. What can they do? And this is, the cards are all in the hands of the UFO occupants. I keep hoping that maybe we discover something like that scene in The Wizard of Oz when a bucket of water makes the witch melt, something as simple as that. You toss a bucket of water on an alien and it melts away. We've discovered that we have some sort of defense, but I don't see that happening. And, we're so much under their control when they want us to be under their control that it's a foregone conclusion that this is not some sort of competition we're going to win.
You know, Dr. Jacobs, and I don't want to keep coming back to him without him being here, but he has written some stuff about aliens being among us, that these other intruders, whatever the heck they are, walk among us, that hybrids walk among us, that they interact with us without our knowledge. Do you go that far?
Well, I wrote about such things in Sight Unseen, and I also have encountered situations like that going way back into the early 80s. So I've always been aware of this, but I didn't really make much of it for the reason that I didn't want to lose my audience and have people say, well, this man is completely over the, you know, over the hill here with this crazy stuff. I slipped it in here and there in various books, but I didn't go into it in any detail. Dave has been much braver than I and has gone into it in much more detail, but I do think such a phenomenon is taking place, that there are hybrid beings that look like us, but apparently have the alien skills and psychological ability to control us and so forth. And I think that there are people like that among us. I've never actually met any, but that I know of, shall we say. But the point is that it certainly fits the patterns, and I think I've got enough little case material that, as far as I'm concerned, it's a reality.
You mentioned at the very beginning of the interview that you've got new cases coming in all the time. Are there new wrinkles? I mean, as you said, you've established the basic pattern of what happens to people, the basic abduction kind of experience, that it happens all over the world to different kinds of people from different walks of life, day, night, multiple witnesses, happens to people alone. Are there new wrinkles, though, I guess separate from this aliens among us kind of a thing that you're noticing?
That's one hell of a wrinkle, I have to say.
Yeah, that's a big wrinkle, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm going to be starting work this week with a man here in New York who has had a lot of experiences, including waking up and when he was a young married man and they had a little girl who slept in the room with them. And he woke up in the middle of the night and saw about four or five aliens standing around her. She was sitting up in bed, and he was a black belt karate man. And just as he was getting ready to attack, he didn't know what they were. He said they looked frail. He figured he could take them easily. Instantly, he was paralyzed and fell back on the bed. But the girl said in the morning when they got together and he was they were having breakfast and he was still shaken because his memory, all this, it's all conscious memory. She said, "Daddy, who were those little people in the room last night?" And this man has his daughter lives right near him in New York, but what I was getting to in a roundabout way, he mentioned something that has come up in some cases as a medical condition, which I would be very curious to hear from anybody, any of our listeners who had something like this happen. But this particular man who saw the little figures in the bedroom said when he was about seven, he started to, he realized he was urinating blood, and he was having UFO experiences, which he remembered part of. But at any rate, urinating blood is a very, very dangerous condition, and something I went through and was told right away by the doctor, there are only two causes, either a severe bladder infection or a tumor. And in my case, it turned out to be a tumor, and I lost a kidney as a result to cancer. And so this little boy was taken to the hospital every single day for 30 days. There was no tumor that showed up, but they had to give him powerful antibiotics, which were extremely painful. But I have about three cases which involve this issue of blood in the urine. And this is a very serious medical condition, and I would like to hear from other people because it's something that's quite rare, but it is in a certain sense a new wrinkle.
And if people in our audience have had this experience or know something about it, they should contact the Intruders Foundation?
Absolutely. And the Intruders Foundation is going to be revived because of my illness. We've been very, very behind in everything, but we are going to be reviving our seminars, and whether I'm able to participate or not, and we're going to be continuing with investigations. And Jed, we have several people who are, one in particular, is doing hypnosis with us, and I'm leaving some kind of legacy here, I hope.
Well, I'm glad to hear that the work goes on.
Yes.
All the work, the valuable stuff
Absolutely.
You've done. Is this, one final question, and when the music starts, that's our sign to go. Is it resolvable through science, through the prism of science, or is it something that we need to look at through a different kind of a prism or paradigm?
Well, I don't think there's any way, any paradigm, any prism that wouldn't be useful. I think the whole thing is, this is so complex a phenomenon that any way we can get at it is worth trying. It's very interesting to me that years ago the nuts and bolts people did not like anything that seemed paranormal in a psychological way. They didn't like the idea of mental telepathy being involved, which of course it is in practically every single abduction. They didn't like that, and of course, the people who were trying to turn us into something more spiritual didn't like the nuts and bolts thing, and the people taking soil samples, etc. But you have to have both sides of the subject examined, and probably more will emerge as time goes on. But any tool that would seem to help should be employed. I mean, we're in a situation where we need every single thing we can get and every person with good ideas.
You have to follow the evidence and the experiences where they lead. Bud Hopkins, always a treasure to talk to you. I hope you're around a long time and get to join us again.
Well, that may happen. Who knows?
And I hope you check out the tribute page on the Coast to Coast website. Thanks so much for being with us, and I hope to see you in person sometime soon.
Okay.
Bud Hopkins, all right. Good night, Bud. Bud Hopkins, our special guest. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. Coming up next, John Jensen to talk about ancientcanalbuilders.com, his website. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast.